better put him in the Heisman.
Got that wood right here, baby.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light Seltzer for those anytime easy drinking occasions.
They're going to run and get that boot.
The Arkansas Razorbacks have completed the dream season.
A baseball team that's on the way back, a College World Series title, the Bomb Stadium.
I almost got fired because I went Willie the Boss after I had a little too much sauce.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast.
Trust a big issue right now, fans, Tommy.
Yeah, I mean, and I think trust with the players is the first thing. Trust with fans, I think you're spot on. The first thing that you got to do is rebuild trust between coaches and players, right? Because I think that was glaringly an issue that we saw going on, but then we confirmed it when Chad Morris left that the players didn't trust that coaching staff in a plurality, in a majority on that team. They needed more players to be bought in. For whatever reason, they were not. And I think that the T word there, trust, is at the root of all of it. And maybe it goes back to those initial meetings. We've heard players come on this show and have plenty to say about the fact they never felt like they were Chad Morris's players. And I think that's where it starts, is Sam Pittman has started to pave the road of getting the players to buy into their coaching again.
It's the trickle-down effect. Players need to be able to trust their coach. Fans need to be able to trust their coach having in the right direction. That leads to high school recruits believing and trusting that the Arkansas football is on the right track, leading to parents and coaches believing and trusting that Arkansas football is on the right track. You have to trust this is going to work. That doesn't mean it's going to work, but you have to at least believe and hope and emphasize that it's going to go in the right direction, because if you don't buy into this, it's not going to work. It's not going to work at all.
I think you had all your points right, but maybe I would differ on the order, because you put recruiting like second there. That's where
the
reason I say that is because when do you start building that relationship as a coach? In that high school locker room, it's in that living room, it's in that recruiting process. Chad Morris didn't really get to recruit him. Very few of the players that played for him, he recruited, right? And that's the one thing that Sam Pittman's got to win over the current players. I know that, but where do you start building the relationship? It's not the minute they arrive on campus. You know, that's one thing they've got to start working on. Boy, this time with coronavirus and the inability to meet in person has put a strain on building relationships. You're exactly right. It's all about relationships, and it's all about trust. You want to play for a coach you like and trust? Well, you can't do that without spending time with them.
The reason I bring this up is because Chuck Barrett asked Sam Pittman on the Arkansas Roadshow or whatever they've been doing last week or so, and one of the questions that was asked from a fan is, are you trusting players concerning their workouts, the work they've been putting in, because you're not monitoring them? Here's what Sam Pittman had to say about that.
You give them three different options. You know, you give them an option with weights, an option without weights, and then we send them stretch bands, resistant bands. The key word here is trust. You have to trust that your players are doing what you're asking them to do. And if they're coming from an environment that they're proud of, an environment they like, I think they're going to work out, and you're not going to have to micromanage them. We trust our players. We can't get video back from them or anything like that. Are you working out? We can't do that. So we choose to trust. We think, you know, our big thing is, why can't you come back in better shape than if you were here? If you're a self-motivator, you're going to come back in as quality a shape as you possibly can. We choose to trust that our players are going to do that.
If you've been in Fayetteville the last two seasons or the last three seasons or just one season, or again, there's a freshman, you should have enough motivation just from the outside world who has looked down upon you as a football program. The fact that you've gone 2-10 the last two seasons and 4-8 the previous seasons, that is motivation enough right there to put in your hard work, even if you're not being monitored by the strength and conditioning staff, even if you're not being monitored by your head coach or your assistant coaches, because there should be motivation enough based on where this football is in its current state. And as far as the athletic department goes, whether it's Hunter Yurcheck trusting that his hire in Sam Pittman is going to work, whether it's Sam Pittman trusting the players that he has on campus that they can be the ones to start the turnaround, or if you even look at Sam Pittman's assistants, looking at Ken O'Briles, looking at Barry Odom, looking at the other guys that he hired. Sam Pittman has to trust that he made the right hires because, again, this is his first time coaching Division I football in the toughest division in all, potentially all of sports. So he has to trust that he can still take a CEO-like approach to all of what's going to happen this upcoming season because he really doesn't have any background as far as head coaching experience goes when it presents itself with college football this year.
Isn't that the hard thing right now is having to basically get blind trust really kind of in each other, players back to coaches? It's kind of a two-way street, but, you know, you play the audio there about the conditioning. It's kind of just blind trust as Sam Pittman lays it out there because you're not able to monitor and you're hoping that they're doing their part just in this little way. But, you know, it's a difficult time to build relationships in situations like these. That's for sure.
We also need to trust that we're going to have college football this season. Sam Pittman coaches up on there. Hunter Yurcheck, they need to trust that we're going to have college football. Now, it might not be the college football that we're used to, whether it's season, the fan attendance, whatever the case may be, the different little parts and stuff that could be different, but we still have to trust that this is going to happen this season, that there's a reason behind us putting in all of this hard work and effort. I'm referring to the players at this point, that they're not just going to put all this offseason work in individually and then not have anything to celebrate when it comes to the season, because that is a big thing this upcoming college football season, is that you actually have the sport we all love.
The only thing I trust, Ty, is nothing will be normal. I mean, I think that's the only thing we can trust right now, is whether it's the number of games or the quality of the product on the field or none, the number of fans in the stands, as you said. That's the only thing I trust. I don't expect anything to be, it's just like usual this fall.
This is going to be the most unorthodox, weird college football season of my lifetime, maybe to those listening, even in your lifetime. I would not expect the scenario to lay out as we plan, whether it's like picking the favorite, the Heisman favorite, the national championship favorite. I would tend to think it's going to be a very odd season leading to an odd number of things come at the end of the year.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a premium light lager brewed with real lemonade.
Now he does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number three, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs! Holy Hog!
So this mock draft I referred to, Kristen Peek of Rivals and Yahoo Sports, might get her on later in the week. The first time I've seen of any mock draft, whether it's Bleacher Report, whether it's Rivals, whether it's NBADraft.com, whether it's ESPN, regardless of which mock draft you've been looking at, I have not seen Mason Jones above Isaiah Joe in a single one. Not a single one. She has Mason Jones slotted at 45th and Isaiah Joe slotted at 55. I don't know if I should be like surprised, if I should be against. It was just an odd thing to see those rankings with Mason above Isaiah in this mock draft.
Yeah, I mean, it is consistently been the other way around, and you kind of wonder why. And we've always kind of explained it is because the ceiling for Isaiah Joe, the perception is it's just higher, that his level for improvement because of his age and just because of his game, he's got more, you know, stored up potential or more headroom to be a better player down the road. So but Mason Jones, I think, is a guy that can help your team right now. You know, the question is at what level?
And the question that still needs to be asked, and we haven't really touched on this subject in a while, is Isaiah Joe going to stay in the draft? Is he going to stay and go on to his next level, to his next journey in the National Basketball Association? Really haven't heard much on that matter, so that doesn't mean it's closed either way, but that's a question you need to ask, because if Isaiah Joe doesn't go, then that's obviously one of those things that Mason's going to go above Isaiah, because Isaiah's not going to enter his name in the draft. But I refer back to what I saw in the NFL draft this past season, where Henry Ruggs, Alabama wide receiver, was drafted above Jerry Jeudy. Now, I looked across mock drafts all over the place, and Jeudy was mocked above Henry Ruggs. Now, Henry Ruggs ran like a 4.2 something at the combine, was just blazing speed. If you watched him any Alabama football this season. Guy is as fast as it gets, just like lightning. Yep. But Jerry Jeudy's the better route runner. He projects as the better NFL wide receiver. But yeah, Ruggs was drafted before him, and it left some GMs, it left some NFL analysts puzzled. It's like, why is this happening? And not only was he drafted above him, he was also drafted above CeeDee Lamb, the Oklahoma wide receiver. So just because someone is mocked above another player, particularly teammates, doesn't mean that NBA GMs and execs see and have that same lens that so many of us have when it comes to looking at Isaiah Joe and Mason Jones.
Yeah, and how does it change this year, knowing that all the pre-draft analysis, workouts, private workouts, all the combine, all the things you do going into the draft aren't happening? You know, how does a player like Mason Jones that needs to be able to stand out with something other than his college film? Not that there's anything wrong with the film he had from this last year, but now what can you do to add to that? Well, that opportunity really for all these players, but these two in particular we're talking about, isn't there. Because I think you best describe these guys as fringe draft players, right? They're fringed in the draft. They're going to be somewhere late second round. Seems to be the best projections for them by, or the consensus. So they need those opportunities to stand out, particularly for Mason Jones. And right now, it just doesn't, you know, those opportunities aren't there to present your tools to the team.
We mentioned that this could be a weird college football season. As Tommy just stated, it's also going to be a weird draft season. You saw some points in the NFL draft where people were a little puzzled and concerned on why a team went a certain direction. I think you'll see the exact same thing in the NBA because of there hasn't been as many in-draft evaluations. It's just been a weird timeline. Stuff's gotten pushed back and a bunch of other different things. That leads you to believe that the NBA draft is also going to be odd. There's going to be some oddities within it and some things you didn't expect, which is okay and it's fine. And maybe that's helpful for Isaiah Joe and Mason Jones, because at the end of the day, you look at their skill sets. Isaiah Joe, 3-and-D guy, probably at the next level. We'll see what happens if he can develop more of his pull-up game, getting to the rack, and just everything doing off the dribble. Mason Jones, for his athleticism deficiencies, the guy can put the ball in the basket. Like, he is a scorer. Now, I don't know how he projects to the NBA level, but you've heard many scouts that say he has an NBA-level type game. He's patented his game off Manu Ginobili, Luka Doncic, James Harden. He's picked apart and picked things from NBA players to model his game after, which is important because you translate your game to a certain extent when you venture from college basketball to the NBA. So maybe teams overlook some of his lower skill sets on the defensive end and his athleticism side, say, this guy can just score. Let's take a chance on him.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the night, they still determine the winner by points, I believe. So it's still about getting the ball in the hole. And the question is, what can he do defensively to bring his game up another notch or two? Was he being asked to play that way? That's been Clay's argument when we've had this discussion, that he was being asked to do certain things on defense that you know, may not have fit his game the best right now because they needed his energy available on the offensive end of the floor. So he was put in some tough spots, particularly that, what, five-game stretch when Isaiah Joe was out. He had to put the team on his back. And they didn't win a lot of games, but it was clear who the leader, who the alpha was on this team. And he's got that quality about him.
Bob in Paris texts in. He says, I think no combine helps make it, Mason. His film will be better than his measurables. Well, we had Sam Vecenie on of The Athletic a couple weeks ago, Bob. And one of the things that you do see with NBA workouts and stuff is 3-on-3. And Mason Jones would be a bull in a china shop if given the opportunity to play 3-on-3 basketball, because he's so strong, he's physical, and he can get to the rim, and he can shoot it. So maybe he would excel there. But as you mentioned, Bob, he might not excel when they do NBA draft and NBA athletic type of measurables, whether it's the high jump, not the high jump, but the vertical jump and the different measurables that they're just measuring your skill. He probably would not excel those, and that might cause NBA execs and scouts and GMs to look down upon him. But when he's given the ball, and like, I remember now Kevin Durant and Mason Jones are not the same player, but Kevin Durant, if I remember correctly, could only bench like 120, 125 coming out of college. And
I remember they made fun of him,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And people were like, well, why is this kid, no way this kid's in the NBA. And he said in an interview something to the extent, he's like, I'm going to be paid to score and put the ball in the basket. Well, Mason Jones isn't exactly going to wow people when it comes to his athletic measurables, but then you put him on a court and give him the ball and say, let's go. He'll wow you there. He did it this past season. He didn't have a lot around him. What happens if you surround him with other NBA talent or other guys in summer league, which we'll see what happens with that in Vegas or in Orlando this season. I just think he has a chance. Now, it might be the road less traveled. He might have to work a little bit to get to the NBA, but I think he definitely has a shot. And I think a lot of you Arkansas fans believe that because of his offensive skill set, he can play at the next level.
And he's gotten his body right. I mean, he's lost the weight. We've heard a lot about Mason Jones, leaning up, but he's also put on good weight. He's got good muscle. I mean, you can just look at him and see. You know, physically, he's prepared and ready. That'd be the one thing with Isaiah Joe. Now, you go back to the reference with Kevin Durant. Is Isaiah Joe physically, where he needs to be to play at that level, to be in the NBA? I think the question these guys got to say, is another year of college worth diminishing the risk, lessening the risk of playing overseas or playing in a development league? Because it's just tough that young to make and stay on an NBA roster.
We heard from a source that told us that Isaiah put on 20 to 25 pounds in this past offseason, which is important to continue to grow and develop his body. You have guys kind of doing different things. Mason's losing weight, gaining good body mass and good muscle, and Isaiah's trying to put on weight. So you have kind of a difference in there. But I would say with Mason, he's trending upwards. You've seen him trend upwards since his senior year of high school, going to Link Prep, going to Connor State, doing what he did in Arkansas's year number one compared to year two. He's going up, which I think is important to see that as an NBA scout or GM, to see a guy not shrinking down or losing some of the skill set or not putting in as much effort. He continues to go up. Now, he might flatten off or shrink a little bit at some point because it's going to be more difficult to continue to get better at the next level, but I think you like his projections and the fact that he looks like he's continuing to get better and add more of or offensive stuff to his arsenal when it comes to playing basketball.
Morning Rush brought to you by The Fence Man. If you own a business that needs more security, or maybe you're just looking for better curb appeal, a new fence from The Fence Man can give you both. They've been around for more than 40 years. The Fence Man, they're our buddies, and they can take care of anything from a custom install on any type of fencing. They can do or repair gates for you if that's what you need, or if you need controlled access systems, powered automatic gates, card readers, those type of things. The Fence Man can handle all of that. Be sure and ask about 18-month same-as-cash financing when you call. That's 479-782-3936. Call our buddies at The Fence Man. 479-782-3936. The Fence Man. He ain't afraid of no work.
When you think about Isaiah Joe, his timeline, the NBA pushback, the withdrawal from the NBA draft, so to give players more time on their decision whether to stay in the NBA draft, whether to come back to school if they choose to enter the transfer portal, you still haven't heard anything coming out of Isaiah's camps concerning his decision. I don't know if that leads you to believe that it's a good thing for Arkansas. I don't know if that leads you to believe that he's going to venture off to the NBA. I just know is, regardless of what he chooses, he's going to make the right decision with his family. It's only a matter of time, I think, before you hear something concerning what he decides to do with the rest of his career. And I think it's a storyline that really has kind of drifted off a little bit because of everything going on with the coronavirus. College football, SEC football has kind of re-energized and refocused fans and kind of directed that. But we really haven't heard a lot about what Isaiah Joe's decision or people asking us the question in quite some time.
It does appear, just based on what Musselman has said, the things he said initially when this announcement was made, that they're planning on him coming back. I think he's recruiting, he's looking at the transfer portal, he's evaluating his options, but it sounds, when he spoke about it, and it hadn't been often, that he's working his plan as though Isaiah Joe will be back with the team. Is that the feeling you get from the handful of comments he's made about it?
He said that they're going to be recruiting as if Isaiah is on the team. Now, I don't know I think he's, I don't know if 50-50 is the right measurement, but I think Musk still believes that there's a chance, I don't know what percentage of chance, that Isaiah Joe comes back. But kind of on that note, you've lost out on some players because of that. Like Mac McClung, for example, he's committing today. If Isaiah Joe is still on the team, he's not committing to Arkansas. Now, I don't know if Isaiah Joe is off the team, if you get Mac McClung or you get some of these other good players that have entered the transfer portal. But there is a chance you could have gotten one of these guys, regardless if it's a transfer or a grad transfer. So it's a difficult situation for Eric Musselman and his staff because they would rather have Isaiah Joe back than any other kid in the transfer portal. But at the same time, the longer this delays, the longer you don't know Isaiah's decision, you're missing out on kids that could potentially help you not only this season, but the upcoming seasons as well.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure it hinges in a big part, and then what grows out of this is, you know, what the evaluation is, what the feedback you get from putting your name in. The NBA's got a system much like the NFL that they'll give you feedback and give you an idea of where or if you would be drafted. So I'm sure getting that feedback and just evaluating that and kind of looking at the options are kind of where Isaiah and his camp are at right now. That's the linchpin in all this is what's your feedback on your draft status?
Yeah, and the feedback is necessary in determining, hey, do I need to stay in the NBA or in the NBA draft? Do I need to come back to college? Because we've said many times on this program, Mason Jones had more to lose than gain in our estimation if he came back to school. We think that Isaiah Joe could help himself get to a first round if he comes back. Now, the argument remains, who's going to be the centerpiece of this offense next year? We've had Sam Vecenie say he thinks Isaiah Joe can shoulder the load and he thinks he'll be the center point of the offense. I made the argument before that Moses Moody is going to have something to say about that. And I think even K.K. Robinson, if he can translate to the next level, is going to be a big cog and a big part of that offense as well. It's all going to come down to really the chemistry of the incoming guys, including Vance Jackson and Jalen Tate, and then the other freshmen, Jalen Williams and Devontae Davis. How do they fixate? And then what happens with Desi Sills, Reggie Chaney, Ethan Henderson? How does that how does that all come and kind of get together? How does the offense blend next year, and who takes over? Isaiah Joe could he comes across as a humble guy, and I haven't watched enough of him from a high school standpoint to know if he was ever the guy at Northside. I'm assuming he was the guy at Northside at one point. But the dog mentality that you have to be the number one guy, he's more mild-mannered. He's more keeps himself. That doesn't mean he can't go about it because we've seen basketball players like Tim Duncan who are as like steady Eddie, don't say much as possible, but they get the job done. They're the number one guy. You're wondering if Isaiah Joe can take that next step because you had Gafford 2 years ago. Mason took that last year. Is Isaiah Joe ready to shoulder that load? Vecenie said yes. We've had other NBA guys come on the show and say yes. I would say yes, too. It's just a matter if he becomes that guy over some of the other players that you have on campus.
How much, because we hadn't seen Moses Moody, but how much does Moses, not at the college level, how much does Moses Moody's game and Isaiah Joe's game complement or conflict each other? Because I think that's one thing that's a factor in how you design this team next year and, you know, figuring out roles. You know, the ball, there's only so many possessions, so many points to go around. You know, how do these guys coexist in the same offense?
We heard from Moses Moody, like talking about different people talking about his game. As good as he is, he was unselfish. He was willing to give up the ball because he's playing with guys like Cade Cunningham, number one player, number two player, depending on what service you look at in this recruiting class. He had the ability to do that. I think Isaiah Joe took a backseat to Mason last year. I mean, you could say necessarily on his own accord or if he did that because it was better the offense, but we've heard Musk talk about if Isaiah does come back, he'll be in some more ball screen situations, more ball stuff situations. It won't be to the extent of Mason Jones, but you'll definitely see him more on the ball and get him more looks. It's just a matter of, do you think these freshman guys, as talented and as heralded as this recruiting class is made to be, do you think they're going to be ready for the next level? Because if they are, if they're as good as advertised, and if they make and really get it done, what that's going to do is it's going to alleviate some pressure off Isaiah Joe And it's probably going to give him less touches because if these guys are geared up, ready to go, and Desi has the type of season that he did towards the end of the season, then the ball's going to be spread around more, which as an Arkansas fan, you love because that means there are weapons at every single spot. There'll be points next season where you have five shooters on the floor and it's five out, no in, and you won't be able to guard because it'll be tough defense-wise because everyone on the floor can shoot. But what that does, if you do have guys that translate as the freshmen, if Desi keeps it up, if Vance Jackson, Jalen Tate can provide you sparks on offense, then that's going to take away less looks and really less pressure off Isaiah Joe, leading me to believe that he's not going to get as many looks as Mason Jones got this past season.
Yeah, because Moses Moody, when you look at his draft projection for the following draft, what were we saying it was yesterday?
He was 13th on Bleacher Report, 20th on NBA draft side, and I think 22nd on another side. So this is a guy where...
consensus first round.
Yes, he's like 30th, 37th, I think on 24/7, 40-somethingth on Rivals, and yet his NBA mock draft projections have him in the lottery and in the first round. So that shows you how much people can think he's going to translate at the next level.
One and done, potentially.
Type of mentality,
So next year, if those two guys are there, you can't take the approach that, well, with Moses, you'll wait till the next year when Isaiah Joe's not there. There probably won't be a next year with Moses Moody if everything goes as planned or to potential.
And it's, again, if they live up to the hype.
Right.
Freshmen don't, regardless of how good they are in high school, they don't always translate to college like people think they are. So it's all a matter of, hey, can you handle this same type of defense and same type of pressure at the next level? It's good that Moses played at the number one team in high school basketball this last year, but it's a completely other thing when you step on that court in your first college basketball game.
The experiences that I had on campus as a student and also playing basketball here prepared me for all kinds of things in life. The confidence that we got from being part of a successful program, having a coach that was so good and made us work so hard, I think allowed all of us to pursue different career goals that we just felt like that we could have done anything.
All right, let's welcome in Jim Counts, member of the Arkansas Sports Hall of Fame, first Eddie Sutton recruit, and worked alongside Coach Sutton in 1981 and 1982. Dr. Counts, good morning. Thank you for making some time for us. I know you're really busy. We've heard from James Dickey yesterday. We've heard from so many other players that Coach Sutton and his staff and his team and his wife, it was a family affair. How quickly into your time at Arkansas did you realize that you made the right decision coming over from Memphis?
Well, I guess to sidestep that a little bit, I felt that way when Coach Sutton was recruiting me. He was different from any of the other head coaches that had recruited me. Coach Bowles always talked about coaches having the it factor, and Coach Sutton had it all over everybody else. He carried himself with a certain attitude and a certain confidence that was remarkable and set him apart from just about everybody else. I knew after our first practice that we better get something accomplished or else he was going to kill us, one of the two, because, I mean, it was all about hard work. It was all about doing what he taught us and being demanding, and yet doing it with compassion and with an attitude that we were a team. It was not pitting anybody against each other. So it was, just a great experience in my recruitment and in the first few days in practice.
You mentioned his legacy has moved on. Why do you think his influence still lingers within you, your former teammates, and within the Arkansas basketball program?
How remarkable is it that Coach Sutton's been gone from Arkansas for now 35 years, and yet the state still has an incredible fondness for him, and his presence and influence still are here like it was yesterday. I think, we had great success, and that, of course, anytime you have championship teams, the teams, I think, have a stronger bond than those that aren't championship teams. But like any endeavor, when you work very hard together toward a common goal, and you know the sacrifices that everybody made on the team to get to the common goal, that binds you in a way that goes far beyond just the time that you're together at the university, and it's bound all of us together throughout our adult years and our careers, our families and everything. And then the fact that Coach Sutton has been good to maintain a thread with us through all that time has made it easy for all of us to have that togetherness and that bond with him still to this day.
Dr. Jim Counts with us here on the Morning Rush. You played for Coach Sutton. You coached as a member of his staff. Walk us through what led you, when your playing career was over, to make the decision to join Coach Sutton's staff as a young coach.
You know, when you're winning basketball games, it's just fun. There's nothing that replaces winning. And you can do everything right as a coach, and yet if you don't win ball games, it's just not as much fun, and it don't have the same feeling of accomplishment. But we won ball games and we won championships, and it was just fun. And I felt like that Coach Sutton had instilled in us a knowledge of the game that I really wanted to spend some time teaching. I felt like it would have been a waste to have that training from him and that knowledge from him and not be able to impart it as a coach. And so I was given an opportunity to do that, and I jumped on it. Of course, eventually I ended up going to medical school, but I can tell you the time that I spent here with the coaches, with him was great. And the other great part about it was to see that he was the same man in the coaching locker room as he was in the players' locker room, that when you step on the other side of the curtain, that there's not something that was different about him, that he was hiding from the team or anything like that. So I appreciated that very much also.
How did the conversation go when you made the decision to leave coaching and go to medical school? I understand Coach Sutton put another recruiting pitch on you at that point to stay. Tell us about the conversation. What can you tell us about Coach Sutton trying to keep you in coaching?
I'd come as an undergraduate intending to go to medical school, and at the end of my playing career, I applied to medical school and was accepted. At that time, you could defer your admission for up to 3 years, or for 3 years, and then the fourth year, if you weren't admitted at that time, then you would have to reapply. So during that time, I deferred my admission, and I was coaching. And Coach Sutton, nearly every day, would say, "You know, you ought to go to medical school. You ought to go to medical school, and everything." He said, "You can keep coaching as long as you want to, but eventually you need to go to medical school." So one day, it came time. UAMS said I either had to come or reapply, and I had spent a lot of time with my wife discussing this and prayer about it and everything, and finally come to the decision that I was going to go to medical school. I walked in Coach Sutton's office about 2 weeks before school starts and said, "Coach, I'm going to medical school." And he stopped and looked at me for a second, and then he said, "You know, that's the right thing. You should go on." And I said, "Okay." I felt really good about it. I walked next door. I cleaned out my office, and I walked out, and by the time I got home, he was calling me and saying, "You know what? I don't think you should go to medical school. I think you could have a great career as a coach, and I think you should stay and remain in coaching." And he and Patsy, his wife, took Kathy and I out to eat that evening, and we ate at the old Mountain Inn in downtown Fayetteville, and he put a big pitch on me that he thought I could do more as a coach than I'd ever do as a doctor and everything. But it was too late. I had spent too much time and too much effort into decision making, and I had this, and I already notified UAMS that I was coming. And so I said, "Coach, I'm sorry, but I'm going to go ahead."
Do you ever?
And he was completely supportive of that. So I got to thank him for that.
Do you ever wonder what your life would look like today if you'd remained in coaching and not went into the medical profession?
Yeah, I'd have had a 3 or 4 game losing streak somewhere and gotten fired is what would have happened. I mean, isn't that what happens to every coach sooner or later? They all get fired.
Yeah.
I hate it for them. They get paid a lot of money, but boy, the pressure is brutal, and your job status is tenuous, and the demands are incredible. So I think that I think it would have been fun. You know, what every athlete and what every coach enjoys most about coaching is the feeling in a locker room, on the road, and in an arena where you have won a game, a tough game that no one expected you to win. And that feeling of togetherness and of shared accomplishment is hard to recapture in any other profession. And that's what's great about playing. That's what's great about coaching. And that's what everybody misses when they're away from athletics.
Jim, off Tommy's question, did you prefer being called coach or doctor? Is there one that you liked better?
Well, I'll answer to either. I still have some guys that call me coach. Charles Ballantyne, Joe Klein, who are very good friends now, they still call me coach. And I think that that's funny. You know, otherwise, I guess much more likely to be referred to as doctor these days.
Doctor and coach Jim Counts with us on the Morning Rush. When you got to campus, you were joined alongside one of the best initial recruiting classes that Ace Edner had. You had Marvin Delph, you also had Ron Brewer, and then Cindy Moncrief. He joined you a year later. What was it like playing with that core of the triplets, Jim?
Well, you couldn't ask for a better teammate. What's on nearly every team, you have players that separate themselves talent-wise from the rest of the team, and these three guys separated themselves talent-wise from the rest of the team. And it's easy for them to put themselves on not a big pedestal, but to separate themselves attitude-wise from the rest of the team. It's not a character failing. It's just human nature. Coaching staff tends to treat them in a special way and so on and so forth. But I can say without equivocation, those guys were all about being good teammates. And they were great players that without them we would never have had the success that we had. And yet they treated their teammates like they were equals. They were fun to be with. They were, and I just can't say enough good things about them. I hear, you know, on shows like you guys have all the time discussions about who's the greatest Razorbacks ever and everything. We've had so many good players throughout the years. I've had a long association with the team as a player and coach and fan and everything, and seen all the great players that we've had. But in my heart of hearts, I really believe those are the three best players that we ever had.
And you were the leading assist guy in 1978. How much easier did those three individuals make your job as far as your assist in the status category?
Well, you know, there's two parts to an assist. It's the setup and then the score. And if you're making the setup and they're not completing the score, you don't get an assist. So having guys like that that can finish the play make it easy to get assists. And that was my job. I mean, I was looked upon as a defender and a guy to manage things on the offensive end as far as getting the ball to the scorers and places that they could score. But believe me, it wasn't all about me setting them up. They were perfectly capable of creating their own shot and making great plays without having someone make a great pass to them.
You mentioned a moment ago that Coach Sutton was the same person in the coach's locker room as he was on the practice floor with the team. Paint a picture for our audience here. Give us, you know, for the audience that only saw Eddie Sutton on TV or only read his quotes in the newspaper, give us an idea of who the man was and the personality and the time you all spent together, what you enjoyed most about being with Coach Sutton.
The first thing that you have to have in order to be a great coach or great in any profession is an outstanding knowledge of the profession itself. And I felt like Coach Sutton had that, as I said, all over other coaches. He knew basketball inside out. And, of course, he had played for one of the greatest coaches in history, Mr. Iba at Oklahoma A&M. And so he understood basketball, and there was never any question among anybody that was around him about his expertise and his grasp of knowledge of the game. That was the first thing. The second thing was that because of his knowledge and because of his accomplishments, he had great confidence that flowed from him into the team. You almost felt like you were invincible, and at the end of a ball game when things were tight and you were looking for ways to make things happen to win the ball game, you had this very strong feeling that the guy that was talking to you and the guy that was coaching you knew more than the guy that was on the other end of the floor that was coaching the other team. And then finally, he had great organization. He had great discipline. He had a way of being demanding and yet compassionate. But the most important thing that he did was that Coach Sutton could assemble a team. You can't have five superstars playing out there at once. You have to have some guys that have special talents and special weaknesses, and he did a great job of maximizing player strengths and of hiding player weaknesses and making everybody understand what their role was on the team. And, you know, when you come out of high school, everybody thinks they're going to be a 25-point-per-game scorer, but they're not. You've got to have some guys that defend, some guys that rebound, some guys that score, some guys that make assists, some guys whose role on the bench is to be a supporting player in practice and everything. Coach Sutton was very good at identifying what your role should be, making you understand what that role is, and then seeing that you executed it. And when you executed it, he was great at giving you credit for that. So, you know, one of the things that I don't know that anybody forgets, but that we don't get to see is Coach Sutton was so good in front of a microphone in his press conferences and everything. He was so good at giving credit to everybody on the team and had a presence about him that made everybody think, hey, this guy knows what's going on, and if we'll listen to him and we'll do what he says, then we'll be successful.
No question. I mean, you just look at the record. The one that stands out to me, Dr. Counts, is 8 games is all that was lost in 11 seasons at Barnhill in Fayetteville. How did Coach Sutton go about building not just a home court advantage, but such a dominant home court edge at Barnhill? 8 losses in 11 years, that's unthinkable.
Well, the first thing he did was he won basketball games, and so that attracted crowds. The crowds got there. There was a product that was out on the floor that they could get behind, that they enjoyed watching. They appreciated their coach. It became a cool thing to come to a Razorback basketball game, not only in Barnhill, but also in Little Rock at Barton and also at Pine Bluff at the convention center. And then he also did it with homegrown talent. And I think that that led to the state having a special fondness for the team. You know, Marvin was from Conway. Sidney was from Little Rock. Ron was from Fort Smith. Steve Stroud, who was a starter in my junior year, was from Salem. Steve Shaw was from Kansas City. I was from Memphis. And even though Steve Shaw and I weren't from, you know, from the state, we were from, might as well have been from it as far as being from border states. I was just across the river. We had other great players like U.S. Reed and Chris Bennett and Trey Trumbo that were all from the state. So I think if you look at when our program has had great success through the years with Coach Sutton, with Coach Richardson, with Coach Anderson, with others, it's been with players, and now with Coach Musselman, it's been with players that have come from the state of Arkansas, because that's our best chance to get the absolute best players. I think that we have a better chance to recruit the best players from Arkansas than we have to get, say, the best players from Oklahoma or the best players from Texas or the best players from Tennessee or Missouri or so on and so forth. And so when you have the, I think the fans of the state have a special fondness for homegrown talent.
Jim Counts, Dr. Jim Counts with us here on the Morning Rush. Doctor, I know you got your time, you're pressed for time, so I'll let you go with this. When you think about all that Eddie Sutton did for you, the basketball program, your former teammates, how significant is it to see his name in the practice, in the men's side of the practice facility, to give him some sort of honor with all he did for Arkansas basketball?
It's very heartwarming. You know, Coach Sutton is, Coach Sutton's name is on the floor at Oklahoma State, and I think he certainly deserves that. But as I said, he's been going here 35 years, and still his players in this state have a special place in their hearts for him. And to see him recognized in that fashion, I think is fitting. I think it is something that certainly he appreciated, certainly his family appreciates. And it's a way that we can memorialize him. It's a way that we can, you know, that we're going to have generations of Razorbacks and of students and of people from this state that will never have seen Eddie Sutton coach a single basketball game, but they will know when they come to this campus and they see that facility that a man named Eddie Sutton, who was one of our greatest coaches, lived and coached here and had great accomplishments here. And that is very, very satisfying to me.
Jim Counts, member of the Arkansas Sports Hall of Fame, first Eddie Sutton recruit, and also coached under Eddie Sutton in the 1981-1982 season. Dr. Counts, we really appreciate your time. I know it's precious for you, and thanks for joining us on the Morning Rush.
Guys, thanks a lot. Enjoy your show.
And thanks for being on the front lines right now during everything going on.
All right, y'all be safe, okay?
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a light and flavorful beer for those easy drinking occasions.
The crowd just took, they just threw him out of the game. They just threw him out of the game. He's gotten his second technical, and he's been thrown out of the ball game.
So what questions do you have for Hunter Yurecek coming up at 11 o'clock today? 877-377-6963. I mean, the football. What's going to happen with football this year? Are we going to see how are they going to go back testing? I mean, there's so many questions that I think you can ask him today, but I think the majority of them are going to be predicated on what's going to happen with football this year.
If I'm a fan with season tickets, and I've already paid, I've already ordered, I've already went through all that, and then they reduce the capacity to a third or a half or whatever it ends up being, how do you go about determining who gets what seats? I mean, here's one thing I do know. They're going to let everybody that has a suite have a suite, right? So you start there. You're not going to cut those people. So everyone that's got a private box.
You're telling me the people with more money are going to get their priority seating?
I'm telling you right now, I'm going to be shocked if they say, well, we're only going to go every third box. I will be surprised. Because, hey, we got walls in between us and the social distancing and blah, blah, blah. They may limit it to no more than 10 or whatever the guidelines are at that point. But I'm just going to bet a lot of money right now. The sky boxes and the suites are not going to be shut down. Those are not going to be the first people they anger. So how do you go about it from then on? You got to let so many students in. That to me is one of the, you know, what are your scenarios? What's your plan A? I guess plan A would be, you know, we hope to not have any diminished capacity and everyone's welcome. That's not likely. So what's plan B? You know, here's what it looks like at a half. Here's what it looks like in thirds. And how do you go about accommodating everybody? This may be one of the few times you're glad you didn't sell your stadium out already at this point. Makes fewer people angry.
The limited capacity, I think, is going to be a question that has to come up. Are you going to have a third of a people, half of a people? And Hunter Yurecek is going to address this in a very diplomatic fashion where we don't know where we have contingency plans for each one. I'm just assuming because he said that a week or so ago, if I remember that correctly, and I'm assuming he's going to approach it the same way today. Hey, we have plans for half, we have plans for third, we have plans for right. This is going to how it's going to be if we have, which is again is important because you don't want to have to walk back something you say. It's like we're not having any fans this season. All of a sudden, a vaccine gets the world's back to normal or something. Well,
I just want to know what those plans are. I'm sure they've went through those measures of here's what our plans look like at 33%, 50%, 3/4, whatever it is. I mean, let's be honest. They've had some practice on how to handle the stadium at half. Now let's just see what it is when you've got to go tell season ticket holders your seats are either getting moved or you're not getting them. You were in the lower bowl, but because of social distancing, now you're going to be in the upper deck.
I think it was Iowa State's athletic director a little earlier this week mentioning that they're preparing to not have full capacity. And if I remember correctly, in Ames, they had not sold out all their season tickets. So what could happen is if you bought season tickets, you get to go, and the ones who didn't, you don't get to go. That would make sense to me if you're going to have a third or a half or around that, because I can't remember the exact statistic, but if you bought season tickets, that now again I'm not asking for that to happen. I would love to see those stands full, depending on everyone's health and safety. But that would be something I would think that Hunter Yurecek and his staff would think about. Well, if you bought tickets, if you're loyal to us, and by all means, you get to go.
Just because you hadn't bought tickets doesn't mean you're not a loyal fan. It just means true. You hadn't bought tickets.
But to distinguish the single game ticket holders or that, I would think that Hunter Yurecek would place a higher value on those who have bought season tickets. Not to say that Arkansas fans who don't buy season tickets aren't fans, because that would be grossly stated if I actually believe that, which is not what I'm saying. I would just think that that would definitely factor the equation of what Hunter Yurcheck and his staff are thinking when it it. And this is all under the assumption if they're limiting capacity and limiting attendance in that stadium.
Even that, think about the shuttle buses from Baum Stadium or Lot 56 or anywhere. How do you handle whatever crowd you're going to welcome if there's still social distancing guidelines? That makes it tough because you've left the stadium and you've seen how, it's a can of sardines on some of these transit buses they take back to Baum. Every seat, every square inch of those buses are crammed full to get as many people back down the hill and to the free parking as possible. Even in places where it's permitted parking, where you've got a pass, a parking pass, those buses are full. If we're all supposed to be 6 feet apart, having a mask, and I think a mask is going to be like, I think we're at a minimum. That's like the minimum. I still don't think we're going to have a season without some kind of social distancing. How do you make all that work? How do you make concession stands, bathrooms, getting your ticket? We've heard about paperless tickets and everybody doing it with a phone. Well, you know, there's a good piece of Arkansas's fan base that's got a few years on them right now. How is that going to slow down the process of people trying to access their paperless ticket on their phone to be scanned as they come in? That's not going to be easy. So, it's not just a matter of, all right, every 6 feet we're going to have a butt in a seat. There is so much more to the logistics of running a game day that have to be considered. I hope we hear some more about, here's our plans right now based on these scenarios.
Let's go to the phone lines real quick. Rod is on I-40. Rod, you got about a minute, man. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys. How y'all doing?
We're good, Rod.
I got an idea. I mean, this is about personal responsibility. After all, the governor can't take care of you. And, you know, you can't sit home with your little mask in your living room and, you know, snuggle up to the TV. If you want to come out and go to a game, you should be able to come out, go to a game. If you need to put a small divider between seats, that's fine, but you should understand that it's a waiver. When you come in that public place, you're responsible for your own health.
How would a divider between seats work, Rod?
Well, it would look pretty goofy, actually, but, I mean, I've been working every single day of all this, and I haven't worn a mask yet, so I must be one of the people that are just completely inept or really lucky, but I don't know. I mean, if I want to go to a game, if I got to sit beside somebody, go sit in that stadium, and I'm, you know, maybe a foot from them instead of 6 foot, I'm not going to affect my, I want to go to a game. Yeah. I'm going.
Yeah. You know, they're not, and thanks for the call, Rod. It's not a requirement that you go to the games. It is a choice at the end of the day. And I think Rod brings a good point there.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Bud Light Seltzer, 5% ABV and only 100 calories. We'd put it up against any other seltzer out there.